So, how many of you have worked in the executive compensation market where you call on business owners to discuss ways that they can incent key employees? One, two, three, four, five, six. Okay, everybody who hasn't done that, raise your hands. Anybody care to speculate what one of the advantages of working in this market is? Or there's more than one. Daytime work. Lauren? Larger premiums, oftentimes. An owner's always looking for ways to save taxes, and we'll talk about how that works with these plans. All of those things are absolutely true. I had an interesting discovery. You saw earlier that my hobby is writing books, and I write mostly historical fiction or biography. One day I went on to Amazon, and I was going to order about three or four books to start researching a new title I wanted to write. And the thought struck me, it said, this is tax deductible. I make a profit selling books. I can write off the cost of the research. Now, I would have bought the books anyway because I was curious about them. But it's much easier for a business owner to write a check than it is for an individual to write a check. How many who have worked in this would agree with that? Numbers take on a different meaning in the context of a business than they do in a personal accumulation. So people who will argue with you about whether they should buy a whole life or a universal life or if they should do a SEP or a simple, they will have a very different attitude when you work in the business market. Now, I'm working from PDFs. We've hopefully passed out. If you haven't received a copy of the two handouts, come. But this is my own summary of the type of work that we do in the financial services marketplace. I use this as something of a calling card when I'm introduced to business owners to say, these are the areas where we feel we can be of help to you. We're going to go really deep on the handouts that you received, which are going to be executive dollar or executive bonus, deferred compensation, and split dollar. But the very easiest way that I know of to approach a business owner about life insurance is to talk about key person. So, Mr. Business Owner, do you mind if I ask, is there any debt associated with your business? The answer is going to be yes or no. What do you suppose the typical answer is? Yes. Is the business on the hook for that loan? The answer is always, of course. Now, here's the secret. You form an LLC, a limited liability company. You form an S corporation, not many C corporations, but some. And the primary reason you do that is to protect yourself from liability so that if a claim is made against the business, it doesn't extend through to the personal assets of the owners of the business. That's the whole reason, or the primary reason, you go through the trouble of incorporating. How many small businesses are able to secure a loan without the personal guarantee of the owners? Very few until they're well established and long established. So almost always, business debt is a risk to the surviving owners and to the families of an owner who loses his or her life. So the easiest thing to talk about is, should you have life insurance to protect that loan in the event of death? And you have a reason to be talking to that person. Key person is also, so a way to approach this is to talk about insurable interest. Under the laws of the state of Utah and all 49 other states, plus District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, each of those states and territories have what are called insurable interest laws. An insurable interest law says that because life insurance pays a very large death benefit relative to premiums paid, the beneficiary at the time of the sale has to have a financial loss associated with the death of the insured person. And you need to be able to establish what that loss will be to the beneficiary. And insurance companies will seek to lower the face amount of the policy to a point that the policy's face amount is worth less than the continued life of the person who is insured. In other words, we always want a person to be worth more alive than dead. Now, sometimes people joke and say, I'm worth more dead than alive because I got all this life insurance. Not if the insurance company did it right, because they will always seek to do it. So, one of the things we have to establish is what are the financial losses that a business would suffer if this person died? If it's an owner of the company, do they lose the organizational skills of the CEO? If it's a non-owner employee, why would a business have an interest in insuring the life of a non-owner employee? Any thoughts? Say aloud.
Replacement costs.
Replacement costs. Yeah, these are sort of up here. So one of the first business cases I worked on was a firm that was developing software for the medical industry. They had a great deal of capital that had been contributed by venture capitalists, and they insisted that they have a $2 million life insurance policy on the key engineer who is not an owner of the company, because they realized that until this product came to market, everything that was going to make this a successful business was in his head. Now, he was trying to put it out and help other people understand his vision, but nonetheless, if he passed away, there would be a delay in bringing the product to market. They would have to do a nationwide search to find the best person to replace him. All of this is something that creates a loss for the business and its owners that can be insured with life insurance. And that's really easy for business owners to understand, and at least in my experience, they will say, let's take action on that. Most of the time, the owners of the business itself need insurance for key person reasons, because they are one of the key employees who helps a business survive and thrive. Replace lost earnings and stabilize cash flow. And I want to go sort of deep on the executive compensation, but a fun scenario to play out for a business owner in this situation is to say, imagine that this key engineer has just died. All of the people who are working for him are in shock. We're always in shock when there's an unexpected death. And they know that we're now going to have to figure out how to keep paying them their salary, even though the launch of the product is going to be delayed. What do most of those other software engineers start doing, do you suppose? Jan? They start sending out their resume. They go to Monster or whatever it is, and they begin to look around to see what's out there, because they become concerned, can the company continue to pay me? What do creditors do? If there is a bank loan and a key person or an owner dies, what does a banker do? Jeff?
They call the loan.
Jeff says they call the loan. Jeff worked for Wells Fargo and US Bank for 15 years. If they call the loan, Jeff, can you see that that will cause the bankruptcy of the company? So why would the bank want to act against its own interest in causing the death of this company? Get what they can. Have you ever heard of something called a charging order? So someone explain to me a charging order. Say it loud. So what happens is that when a firm files bankruptcy, creditors have to begin filing with the court to say, I want to be paid in the assets of this company, and the timing of when those are received puts them in line. So the bank always wants to be the first in line. Now there's one party who can muscle the bank out of the way. The Internal Revenue Service can always muscle to the front of it. So oftentimes banks will cause the death of a company because they want to be the first to get whatever is left and to get ahead of the other creditors. When a person dies, the banker calls up and says, hey, Jan, really sorry to hear about Mark's passing. We really need to get together. We've got to talk about the loan. Now, suppose Jan says this, oh, I'm glad you called. I was going to call you to talk about the loan. Banker says, well, why? Well, I want to pay it off. Jan says, and the banker says, what do you mean pay it off? Well, we have insurance. You know, Frank, I just don't want to go forward with this loan hanging over our head. So when would be a good time for me to come in and write the check? What do you suppose the banker says at that point? Wait, Jan. No. Because how do banks make money? By making loans and collecting the spread, right? The employees come in and we call all the employees together. Jan's a surviving owner of the company. He says, you know, Mark passing away is a real blow. He says, you need to know that we have at least 6 months, you can do up to a year, of working capital. Your salaries are fine. We're in great shape to pay you, so there's no reason for you to be concerned about that. We're going to ask you to work extra hard because we've got to figure out how to get a product out. And then when we start calling folks in Silicon Valley to replace this engineer, we're going to have some sort of an incentive to get them to come. Isn't that right? Do you see the difference in these two scenarios? No insurance versus insurance? That's what we do. And that's the most direct way you can get to it. The second is, and I won't go into talk about this, but if Jan and I are the owners of the company and Jan dies, I love his wife, we're on very good terms, but she doesn't know anything about the business. I really don't want to be in business with her, nor, as I continue to drive the success of the business in the future, do I want to share all those profits with her. Likewise, Jan likes Marcella, great person. He would not want to be in partnership with Marcella. You wouldn't want to be in partnership with Marcella, Jan. She might look over your shoulder. And so if Jan buys a policy on my life, and I buy a policy on Jan's life, and I die, Jan collects a tax-free death benefit, writes a check to my estate, they surrender the stock, and Jan is now the sole stockholder of that company. What's the taxation to Marcella if Jan let's say I have a basis in the business of $100,000, and Jan buys me out for $1 million? How is Marcella taxed on the $900,000? Jan says capital gain. The secret is that at death, capital assets are stepped up in value to the fair market value on the date of death. So it's as if Marcella paid $1 million for the business. He writes her a check for that. So an insured by sell agreement is tax-free to Jan, and it's tax-free to my family. We really have the best tools in the tool house to help with this sort of thing. Now, when you have multiple owners, when you have more than one business entity, which is often the case, I favor something called creating a separate limited liability company or life insurance partnership, and a single cross-purchase by sell agreement that has a schedule. Mark Maurice is an attorney, a member of the Society of Financial Services Professionals, well prepared to talk to you, as are many other attorneys, about how you can set up the proper type of agreement to fund people's lives. The third is qualified retirement plans, SEPs, simples, pension plans. What's the maximum money that can go into a pension plan for an individual employee? $53,000, says Anthony. Is that true of a 401k? Yes, it is. Is that true of a profit sharing plan? Yes, it is. Is it true of a defined benefit pension plan? No, it is not. What's the maximum that can go into a defined benefit pension plan? Age and FICA wage base, it's possible to get deductions of up to $400,000 per year if the census is right. So earlier someone said, I don't remember who it was, who said business owners want tax deductions. They're concerned about income taxes. With the right census, you can do a great deal of planning with a qualified pension plan to get to a place. Most people say with the 412(b)(3), which is called a fully insured plan, the problem is that to get a great big tax deduction for the owner, you've got to spend a lot of money on the other employees. There's a relatively new type of pension called a cash balance or target benefit plan. It's a defined benefit, and I'll just give you a for instance. So we had one client who, if he used a 412(b)(3) in combination with a profit sharing plan and a 401k, could defer $430,000. But the cost for insuring the other employees, covering them in the plan, was $100,000. Well, that's a lot to spend to get a deduction for him. By switching to a target benefit plan, we were able to get the employer a $200,000 deduction, but he only had to spend $10,000 on all the other employees for him to get the $200,000 deduction. So just be aware that pension plans can be more than you think. Any questions so far? Let's see if I can scroll up. And now we get to the fourth section, which is called key executive retention plans. In most cases, these need to comply with something called Section 409A. When Enron Tyco, some of these very large companies who were active in energy went bankrupt. They essentially bankrupted their employees because they had directed that all their 401k contributions go into company stock. So when the company stock went broke, the employees went broke. Meanwhile, the executives, I'm not going to be able to tell you the name of one company, it was discovered after the fact that many of the executives had deferred compensation plan and split dollar plans in place. And with insider knowledge of what was coming, they accelerated the payout from those deferred plans, took the money out of the company. Within a year, it went bankrupt. They were multimillionaires, while the rank and file employees were broke. So Congress imposed new rules on the type of plans we're going to talk about today that prohibit this acceleration of a benefit, except under very specific circumstances. So I wish I had the quote with me. It was Andrew Carnegie. Can anybody quote it verbatim? Take away all my factories, take away all my money, take away everything but my key employees, and if I have them, I'll have it all back within 5 years. Andrew Carnegie was the wealthiest man in America when he said that, and he started Pittsburgh Steel and very large corporations. He recognized that the essential building block of financial success as a business owner are the people that you employ and the people who can make things happen for you. There's always competition for the best people. How many of you have ever been recruited by another insurance company? Raise your hands high. Now look around the room. Take a look. This is an important part of our discussion. Why would another insurance company approach you, Anthony?
You're an asset to them. You're a potential asset to
them. You have a proven record of production, and they know that if they bring you over, you can immediately begin to produce business for them, which is why they're in business, right? And so they are constantly after the really good producers. So you ought to be a little worried about yourself if you're not recruited. Because that says the market isn't placing value on you and you're not doing what Dan Clark talked about. You're not making yourself nearly visible enough. So if you've created a successful brand, people will try to take you away. This is true in any industry that you can think of. So the question becomes, how do we incent people so that they stay with us instead of going somewhere else? So what are the options that can happen? Now, these are the ones that work within our industry, but they're not the only tools on the table. So if I own a small business and I want to attract Lauren, what might I offer Lauren? A signing bonus. I might say, Lauren, I'll give you an extra $100,000 just to come work for me, and then we'll give you a competitive salary. That's exactly right. What else might we offer?
Stock options
or ownership in the company. Jake, if you come with our company, we'll give you an ownership interest. Now, stock options are very, very attractive. I mean, we know of people who have become millionaires and multimillionaires because of stock options. But from a practical point of view, there's a problem with stock options for the employer owner, and there are problems for the person who receives the options. If this is a small, privately held company, what are some of those problems?
Company might go out of business.
Company might go out of business, so instead of taking current compensation, I accept an option, and then it fails, and I get nothing for what I've done. Very good. What else?
It dilutes ownership.
And what it means is that as I drive this business towards success, I'm not going to just share the current contribution that Jake makes to the company. I'm going to share all the profits of the company for as long as the company exists. Because I've given that ownership away, and Jake can either keep it or he can transfer it, but I'm sharing profits forever. Great answer. What else? So that's a disadvantage to the employee, that there's restrictions on when I can exercise it. So if I own stock outright, I can sell it when I think the price is best. I have one stock in my portfolio that I'm mad at right now, and I would sell that dog. But my son Jeff, who is my financial advisor, says, just calm down, puffy cheeks. That's what my daughter used to call me. Just calm down, Dad. It's okay. Well, so I don't get to control the timing of options. Others, Mark?
One way to deal with some of those would be to offer payment.
Okay, but you're ahead of me. Damn attorneys. They anticipate where you want to go, and they're there already. Here's the problem for Jake if we give him a minority interest in our LLC. If Jake owns a 2% interest in our company and Jake decides he's going to leave, who's he going to sell it to? Who wants to buy a minority interest in an LLC? Because you know what you go when you got 2%? You got a headache. Because here's the deal. If Jan's the owner of the company and Jake leaves and Jan's mad at Jake, Jan can allocate all the revenue to Jake's 2%, and Jake has to pay tax on it, but Jan does not have to allocate any income. And so it's paradoxical, but you can be the owner of an interest in an LLC, and you can have taxable income with no distributions to help you pay the tax. It can actually reduce your standard of living. I'm going to tell you a true story just because it's fun. So Dan Springer is a New York Life vice president now, I think, in Dallas. Is he still there? He was the office manager in the Salt Lake office. And Dan had a colorful mouth. If this were the University of Utah, I'd quote him directly. But I will refrain from that in respect of the institution we're at. But one day, he says that, dad of mine, I said, what are you talking about? He says, he just makes me so mad. I said, Dan, what's going on? He says, my dad owns a bank, and it's highly profitable. And his estate planning attorney talked him into giving stock to me and my brothers and sisters. I says, this sounds good. He says, it's not good, because we share equally in the taxation of the bank, but dad refuses to give us any distributions of dividends. We get no money. And Dan was colorful in how he felt about that. Well, so Jake, do you really want a minority ownership interest in the company?
It depends if I trust him, which tomorrow I might not.
Yeah, well, so it's hard, isn't it? So there are ways that you can create incentives for non-owner employees, and the discussion today is going to be for non-owner employees. Very few of these things are helpful to the owners of a pass-through entity. That's a discussion for another day when we spend an hour or two talking about how pass-through entities work. But essentially, if I'm an owner of a limited liability company and we have $1 million of revenue and we have $600,000 of expense, including salaries, and Mark Maurice and I are the owners of it together, we're going to be taxed on $200,000, aren't we, Mark, each? The $400,000 profit, who's going to pay the tax? Where will the tax fall? Does it fall on our company, the Mark and Jerry company? What will Mark and Jerry company do so the IRS knows about that $400,000? They will file a form 7063. Do I have that right? 1065. They will file a 1065, which is called an informational return, and they will issue Mark and me a Schedule K-1. And what it'll say is, there's $400,000 of profit, and I owe tax on half of it, and Mark owes tax on half of it. What if we leave the $400,000 in the company's checking account? That's okay. We still owe the tax on it. All it does is increases our basis in the company in what's called a capital account, but we've got to pay the tax. So is it possible for the owners of an LLC to defer compensation? It's not, using this tradition. There's one program called a restricted property trust that can get a 70% deduction. But aside from that, a split dollar is where the company owns part of the benefit and the employee owns part of the benefit. If we're the owners of an LLC, a partnership, an S corporation, can you see that there's no one to split it with? Because from the IRS's point of view, the owners and the company are the same person. Does that make sense to everybody? Any questions? Because this is important. So what we're talking about today is how we create incentive compensation plans for non-owners of the company. And now it doesn't matter what the ownership structure is. If we have key people that we want to do something nice for, we might use one of these tools. Now, by the way, Mark talked about what's called a profits interest, and another thing is called phantom stock if it's an LLC, or I'm sorry, if it's a C corporation or an S corporation. Let me take just a minute to talk about those two because I think they're great ideas, and they always resonate with the owners of these types of companies. So I spent 5 years when I was at New York Life working in their field technology department. I worked on site in Salt Lake at a company called Sterling Wentworth that designed financial planning software. And later, after I went to Beneficial, they were bought out by SunGard. And one of the key people at Sterling Wentworth came and said, I'm starting a new company. And we're going to build software that harvests data from the insurance company's database, and it starts making recommendations to the agent as to people they ought to see and the problems they ought to solve. New York Life uses it. The company is Capital Rock. The tool is called WriteBridge, and it's being very successful. Well, John, the owner of the company, came and said, we would like you to be an advisor and help us to get this going, because they knew my experience in software. And he says, but right now I'm, you know, putting up all the capital for it. And so I says, well, I'd like an ownership interest in the company. And he goes, well, I'm not sure about that. But he said, what I'll give you is a profits interest. So a profits interest is that I have the equivalent of a 1% interest in this company. Now, I put it through my broker-dealer. I got permission. It's an approved outside business activity. And I can offer consulting to Capital Rock to make that happen. If he sells the company for $5 million, I get $50,000. He sells it for $10 million, I get $100,000. That's the deal that we made. But a profits interest is not actual ownership, is it, Mark? It's a pretend interest that says, whatever the value of the company is, if we ever sell it, you get 1% of the sale price. But until then, you don't have any voting authority. You don't have any ability to insist on searching the records of the company. You don't attend board of director meetings of the company. You are not an owner, but you have this share of profits if and when we choose. And we don't have to wait till they sell. He could choose to distribute profits during the life of the operation of the company and share those with me. Well, you can do a profits interest for key employees, and can you see that you're not really giving up as much? But you are putting something on the table. You can do the same thing with what's called phantom stock for an S corporation or a C corporation. Phantom stock says, we're going to pretend to give you shares of the company, but the value of this, it's really deferred compensation. The value of this deferred compensation will be measured by the value of the company, either through appraisal or market value, and that's what will determine what your share is if and when we ever decide to sell the company. And so I own phantom stock. Usually it will be paired with something at retirement so that when the time comes that I retire and I've stayed with them and helped them build the company, I'm going to be bought out by the company for the fair market value of my phantom stock, which means the company better have the money on hand, right? Questions on that? Now, I feel like we're in the deep end of the pool. So, you know, there's some of you who are going, yeah, this is pretty basic. Others of you are going, whoa, what's he talking about? And somewhere in between, hopefully we'll give you some insight. I was talking with Monty Andrus yesterday, the manager of our agency. I said, all I hope to get out of training is that people, when they find themselves in a situation where they go, what can I do for this client, that you will remember something that we talk about today and say, I think there's a solution. You go to your in-house management, your in-house trainers, you're certainly welcome to call me and say, would you talk me back through that? So now let's look at the three. And I want to start with the funnest one first. So you have a handout here called Economic Benefit Regime Split Dollar. If you'll turn to that, I'll try to put it up here on the screen so We're looking at the same thing. I'll make it a little. Do we have more handouts, Jeff? Whoever needs handouts, raise your hand. Yeah, there's a lot of people. Okay. So I like to start out with something that's a real life example. So here we have a male, age 44. He's a key employee of the company. He's not an owner of the company. The company wants to create an incentive plan that holds him to the business. And they're willing to put aside $20,000 a year to make that happen. What they want is that if he quits before 20 years elapses, which is age 65, they want the employee to forfeit everything in the account and for it to remain in the hands of the owners. Now, if you're in a 401k and the company puts in a matching contribution, what's the maximum length of time that they can claw back some of their contribution if you quit? 5 years. This is called cliffhanger vesting if you go five. So you can go five. If an employee quits in the first 5 years, the company can take back its contribution. You can have graded vesting to seven, 20, 20, 20. There's combinations, but the point is that at some point the money that goes into the plan vests, and the rules are made by the federal government. In a non-qualified deferred compensation plan or a split dollar plan, there is no one to protect the interest of the employee except the deal they negotiate with the company. Now, why would the government be so disinterested in these key people? It's what everything in the class today rests on. Jeffrey? Jeff says they should be smart enough to look out for their own interest. They should be well placed enough that they can negotiate a good deal. So the government says, if you deal with the top hat group, so top hat's what the little guy in Monopoly wore, and it used to be the sign of someone who is financially successful. So actually in the code, it talks about a top hat group. It says, if you provide a benefit to members of the top hat or the highly compensated group, then none of the vesting requirements, none of the non-discrimination requirements of ERISA apply. That employee is on their own. Well, this gives you enormous flexibility. So in this case, we've designed this so that if the employee quits any time in the first 21 years, the company can keep all of the money in the policy and keep the policy, and the employee has no recourse against that. But if they get to 21 years, they fulfill the terms of their split dollar agreement, the company agrees to bonus the policy to the employee, and the employee enters retirement with, so you'll see here that the company got, let's see, I think I've got a laser pointer if I can make it work. Aha. Uh-huh. Well, something red is happening. There we go. So the company puts $20,000 into the plan and it is not deductible to the company. So they give up a tax deduction. But they own the cash value of the policy, which is the net surrender value. The company owns an interest in the policy equal to the cash surrender value, and they own a share of the death benefit equal to the surrender value. The current incentive to the employee is that we say we will allow you to name a beneficiary for the excess death benefit that's created by this $20,000 payment. Turns out to be about $466,000. So we're going to give you free life insurance if you die, and if you stay with us for 21 years at age 65, we will bonus the policy to you. The employee takes, at that point, the company is going to get a tax deduction for having transferred the policy. The employee takes enough money from the policy to pay the tax that's due because he just received $870,000 of compensation. And at that point in time, the employee starts taking tax-free income from the policy of $60,000. If you turn your page over, you'll see that that goes all the way to age 100. 65 to age 100 times 60,000, that's how many years? 35 years times 60,000 a year, how much are we talking? About $2 million, right? How much?
30 years, close to 95.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Ken. So 30 times 60 is $1.8 million that the employee receives tax-free. What's the remaining death benefit? $700,000 goes to the employee's family. So here's the deal, Scott. We want to put a plan on your life. It will provide free life insurance protection to you. We're going to own the policy, but if you stay with us till retirement, you'll have a plan that will provide $1.8 million of tax-free income during your life. Now, that's based on the current assumptions. And at your death, your family will inherit whatever is left. Currently, that would be $700,000, $2.5 million of tax-free benefit to your family. Is that worth holding on to if you're Scott? Is that a benefit with the passage of time makes it harder for you to listen to the other company who's coming and trying to take you away from us? It's called golden handcuffs.
What about the economic benefit?
Oh, well, you're just like a damn attorney, Warren. Oh, I said damn. I'm not supposed to say that here. Okay. How is it that this benefit is tax-free to... How is it that this death benefit is tax-free to Warren's family? Well, what the IRS said is, so you bought a policy, you own it, you're the beneficiary, Mr. Company, and you're not taking a deduction for it, but you're going to give $500,000 of tax-free benefit to Warren's family. There should be a tax in there somewhere. Now, I would argue, well, there is a tax in there, you bozos. We paid tax on the $20,000. That's not enough for the IRS. They says, nope, you've given an economic benefit to Warren. So for Warren to receive this tax-free, or his family, he has to pay tax on an amount equal to the cost of buying life insurance out on the open market. Well, so insurance companies use what's called the cheapest price term policy they have for sale. And we say, so Warren, for you to get this $463,000 tax-free, you have to pay tax on $264. Warren's in a 40% bracket, so it costs him $90 to have $500,000 of insurance. Good deal for Warren? What do you think? Think of how the math works on this, because it's really good math. If Warren had to go out and buy the policy, and if he could find a policy for $264 a year, I don't think he could, but if he could, he'd have to earn $500 in order to have $260 left. As it is, he's taxed on $260, and it costs him $90 in taxes, so this is the most efficient way possible for Warren to buy this policy. Now, as Warren gets older, and he's very old now, we were very good friends from the very first days of my career. Notice that economic benefit increases in price, but it never becomes cost prohibitive. It's also established basis in the plan for Warren so that when the policy transfers over to him, he doesn't have to pay tax on all the economic benefit he recognized in the earlier years if he had the sense to keep track of that. That's deep. I appreciate that that's deep. Just understand that the death benefit's tax-free to Warren's family, tax-free to the company. And Jeremy, you had a question.
You should be advising them to pay the taxes on the policy every year.
Well, what will happen is the company will either increase his W-2 income or give him a 1099 for the amount of the economic benefit. So Warren will pay tax on it. Now, if Warren is well-placed in the company, remember what Jeff said, these guys can watch out for themselves. What could Warren negotiate? What's called a double bonus. He could say, I like this thing. I mean, that's good, but I don't want to pay any more tax. And he could negotiate for the company to give him the extra $60 plus the tax on $60 to make sure that the company offsets the taxable event to him. Does this look like a good deal for Warren?
Absolutely.
Does this look like a good deal for the employer? Because if Warren walks away at year 10, the employer has $178,000 of cash value, and they get back all the death benefit that was on Warren's life, and they now have a $800,000 policy on this employee who left. What most companies will do is use what's called an insurance exchange rider to move it to the life of another key employee. So the company's risk is reduced because it's intended to hold Warren. If it doesn't, they're able to put the money to other use. So this is called split dollar. This is one example of it. It's a complex process, but essentially, oh, I remember I was going to do this. The first time I learned about split dollar, Roland Nebaker was in the room, and he went, so here's the way split dollar works. You pay tax on this part. Your family receives this part. How's that, Mr. Employee? Pretty nice, huh? So that's what split dollar does. It splits the cost and the benefits of the policy. This is actually split dollar combined with deferred compensation because we're promising Warren that we will pay him this policy in the future. Any questions? Yeah.
Are you going to talk some more about deferred comp?
Sure. Yeah, in fact, that's where we're moving next. Any questions on split dollar? All right, let's move on. So the next one that I want you to see is, go to your handout. And we're going to talk about deferred compensation. There's two types of deferred compensation, employer-sponsored and employee-pay deferred compensation. So the easiest way I know how to tell you this is to talk about the deferred compensation plan I participated in before Beneficial excommunicated me from the company. It was owned by the LDS Church. They fired 200 of us. This is 8 years ago. They were nice to us. But prior to that, I'd participated in a voluntary deferred compensation plan. So the way that it worked is Beneficial set up a plan for highly compensated employees. Earlier I said you want to cover the top hat group. Remember that phrase? How do you define the top hat group? There's a number of ways. One, if it only includes highly compensated employees under the IRS definition for qualified plans, 120,000 or more a year, that may qualify me to be part of the top hat group. A second is if I'm an owner of the company. A third is if I'm an officer of the company. And the fourth is if I'm in the top 20 to 30% based on compensation, then that can establish that I'm part of this select group of employees who do not need the protections of ERISA, and therefore I don't have the restrictions of non-discrimination testing. Well, I fell in that group. So what Beneficial said is, Jerry, you can defer up to how much? What's the maximum that an employee can put in a deferred compensation plan? Say it loud. 100%. Now, what's the limit on a 401k? 53,000. What's the limit on target benefit plan, 200,000. The limit in a deferred compensation plan is up to 100% of compensation. So what some people did is they said, I'm already putting into my 401k, I'm putting in 15%, I want to put in a total of 35% of my income, and Beneficial held that money out of their paycheck. I said put in any bonus money that I qualify for. So if the company hit certain targets, I qualified for a bonus, they would put that into the deferred comp plan. And when I say put it into the plan, what Beneficial did is they went out to SEI. How many have heard of SEI? Large managed accounts fund manager. And SEI set up an account that is owned by Beneficial Life. They're the owners of it. They're the beneficiaries of it. But they subdivided into little accounts, one of which had the name Jerry Borrowman on it, one of which had Chuck Cutler, Tyler Norton, other people at the company. And when they sent a bonus check, instead of sending it to me so that I paid tax on it when I earned it, they sent it to SEI and said, put this in Jerry's account. And they allocated it to my account. I had choice over where it was invested, you know, in the offering. And that money began to accumulate in an account that was owned by Beneficial. What was it that caused it so that it was not taxable to me currently?
Deferred.
It's deferred. So there's two tests that you have to pass if you don't want something to be taxed to you currently. The first test is called the constructive receipt doctrine. And if I had a whiteboard, I'd write, I do have a whiteboard. Wow. So the first doctrine is called constructive receipt. So suppose that, okay. Well, I can see it. For those of you who can't see red in a dark room, that says constructive receipt. If Cambridge Financial puts a check in my checking account on December 27th of this year, but I don't write a check against that until January 2nd of next year, which year am I going to be taxed on it? Jeremy? Which one? 2016. I'm going to be taxed on it in the year in which I, 2015, thank you. I'm going to be taxed on it in the year that it becomes available to me, whether I choose to use it or not, because I could write a check on December 27th, right? So that's called constructive receipt. The second doctrine that has to pass is the IRS says, even if you don't have constructive receipt, suppose a beneficial sent it to a trust that I didn't have any access to for the next 10 years. But that trust was irrevocable and it was set aside exclusively for me. And at the end of 10 years, I was going to get it no matter what. The IRS, you would say, well, I didn't have constructive receipt of it until 10 years in the future. The IRS would say, you earned the money in 2015, it was put in the account in 2015, and there's no risk that you'll never receive it, you're taxed in 2015. So if you're going to set up a deferred compensation plan, you have to create a barrier that says, I don't have constructive receipt, and I may not get the economic benefit. I may lose it somehow. So how do you do that, do you suppose? Lauren has said, yes.
But the point is, Gary, that account has your name on it, but you don't own the account.
Yes, that's exactly right. It's an asset of beneficial life, not me. And what could happen to beneficial life? They're an insurance company. They will never go bankrupt. There are some people in the room who just coughed nervously when I said that. So the fact is that when a company sets this up, the money that is set aside for my use in the future is subject to the creditors of the company. And if the company goes broke, I'm one of those guys getting a charging order and getting in line behind the IRS, the bank, and all the others, and I may or may not get the money. That's called a substantial risk of forfeiture. Forfeiture means to forfeit. I may not get the money. Now, I thought that the safest place in the world to have my deferred compensation money was in beneficial life. 105-year-old company, good solid balance sheet. They had a high surplus ratio. What I didn't know is that they had invested 55% of their assets in mortgage-backed securities. Now, a lot of us in the room work for Beneficial Life. We got a notice 7 years ago that said Beneficial was actually the first company in the world to call Standard & Poor's. How many? Oh. First company in the world to call Standard & Poor's and say, we think we got a problem. The effect is that Beneficial Life had a $300 million surplus. That means their owner equity, which is owned by the LDS Church, and they had to infuse $600 million of capital to keep the company from going bankrupt. Had the LDS Church not chosen to act in behalf of its policyholders and employees, I would have forfeited the $300,000 I had in that account. I would have lost it. So do you see why I wasn't taxed on it currently? Because there was a very real chance that I would never get the money. I didn't think there was, but there was. So no matter how good the company is, the employee is doing an act of faith to put their money into the plan. Now, the good news is this. The church did put the money in. The policies have operated successfully. 2 months ago, Beneficial Life wrote a check to the church repaying all $600 million. So they're solid, and they're earning very good profits. And when I retire, I will begin to collect the money from that account over 15 years when I turn 65. From my point of view, deferred compensation is great because it's like a 401k without contribution limits. From the employer's point of view, they're deferring their deduction to when they actually pay me the money. But it builds a great deal of loyalty. Now, they could also put money in that was their money, not mine. So they could say, we're going to share 10% of our profits with you every year, and if you want, we'll put it in this deferred compensation plan. And that becomes an incentive for me to stay. This is really important for the high-end planning. So I'm running low on time, but I want to explain 409A. 409A is rules that you have to comply with if you set up a deferred compensation plan that says, I have to pick a date in the future when I'm going to start taking the money, and I can't accelerate the payment earlier than that date. I can postpone it, but I can't accelerate it. There's other rules to comply with. So if you decide to market this, how can you fund a deferred compensation plan? I told you one, you can put it in mutual funds. You can also put it in a life insurance policy that is owned by the company that will accumulate the money in the future, and my interest in the plan is the cash value of the policy, and when I retire, that becomes the money that is paid to me. So it's a way for me to buy life insurance with pre-tax dollars. So we didn't talk about executive bonus, and obviously there's more, but executive bonus is simply, if I don't want to have to create a plan, if I don't want to have my money at risk of forfeiture, I can ask my employer to, or the employer can volunteer to simply buy a life insurance policy and pay the premium. And if they do that, it's deductible to the company because they're going to treat it as salary. It's reportable as taxable income to me, but I own the policy free and clear. How many of you would like it if your primary carrier came to you and said, hey, Darren, you're doing such a great job. We're going to start putting $10,000 a year into a life insurance policy that you own.
Love it.
Would this build loyalty to the employer? It does. And when, so here's the funny part about this. If Darren decides to quit and go somewhere else, all he's got to do is negotiate a big enough raise to pay the premium, right? But he doesn't want to do that. Because somehow having the employer pay for it feels really, really good. And that's the magic of executive bonus. I will be here. Come ask me questions if you have them. I'm at Cambridge Financial. You're welcome to call. So I would love to talk to you more about it if you have questions. And with that, we're done. Thank you.